welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. Folks, the national debt, you hear me say this every day, the national debt is fraud. We have a way within the Constitution of taking our government back by demanding the full rule of law, the full compliance of the Constitution. Ergo, as we go through this content, we are going to show you how the constitutions that were written for most all of the states from Indiana, 1819 or 1816, let me pull it up, I'll give you the exact day, that Indiana was brought into the Union. And so Indiana was December 11th, 1816. Madison was duly out of the presidency. Monroe took over in 1817. And therefore, they started taking latitude, federal latitude, in admitting states into the Union. Now, Monroe wasn't at the Constitutional Convention, so he didn't understand the equal footing. And therefore, he wasn't going to keep check. And as a matter of fact, being a military man, unlike Madison, Madison was the only president to actually lead the U.S. military in battle. But as we look at how things migrated in states being admitted into the Union, we can clearly see that at the end of 1816, at the end of Madison's tenure, Congress reached into, we're going to get into the Indiana Enabling Act. We're covering that now. And so what we want to do is prove to you, because folks, as we show how the federal government literally violated the things that they did was not legitimate. What this does is this poses the challenge. If your state joined the Union after 1816, then guess what? The federal government placed unconstitutional burdens upon your state that they had no authority to do. Therefore, one must actually examine your state constitution and say, well, you know, and look at the Enabling Acts and see where it started. Because after they did that, most people think, oh, well, everything west of the Mississippi. No, not west of the Mississippi. It was east of the Mississippi where they started overreaching. And so this begs the question. Actually, it begs the need for rewriting many of the state constitutions because there were very specific clauses that the federal government put into your state constitution that they had no authority to demand that be injected. And I don't believe any state in the Union should be strapped to some unconstitutional clause that says they're an inseparable part of the Union. And most all the states after the Civil War have that clause. Most all of them, I think every single one of them does. I haven't looked at all of the constitutions, but I'm pretty sure because it's the consistency. They wanted to make sure that no state could ever think that they could get away. And that's not how it goes. We've gone through this many times, and this is why we're going to kind of summarize the Enabling Acts today. But the whole point is we're teaching you. This goes into your appeal to heaven. As you start appealing to heaven, and as you start learning the magnitude of the violations, you can start seeing what really needs to happen to fix these things. You have to create your county constitution first. You have to create your county constitution first. Do not call for a state constitutional convention until your county constitutions are done. Everybody in all the counties, at least these dark red counties, need to cut their teeth in understanding what they put into that constitution. You don't go into the state constitutional convention without at least having a profound understanding of what you need to make sure you do. Why is this important? Because when you create that state constitution, when you go in and make the massive changes that needed to be made, you need to make sure that certain clauses are not injected or left in that constitution. You want to make sure that all the power is basically centered in your counties, not at your state. This goes to the whole concept of a hybrid constitutional republic, where there are literally three tiers of power. The county power, where the mass and the residual power is to be. The state power is a general power to serve the sovereignty of the people and their counties. And then the federal power, which is a general power to serve the sovereignty and protect the sovereignty of the states. Therefore, when we look at who should be making the decisions regarding whether you're going to have, you know, compassionate health care by the state, chances are no. Most everybody will probably say, no, we don't want that. We want to have a free market system. And therefore, this is where the real settlements and the real changes will occur, because when you have the majority of the counties in your state saying the state's not going to administer a health care plan anymore, then now you actually have the full control. And that's why you start understanding by doing county constitutions, you're going to understand what powers should not be delegated to that state, because you want them to be delegated to your county, if at all you want them delegated to your county. So remember, the usual adage of ignorant people is, we got to make a law for this. This is wrong. We got to make a law for that. No. You have to change the Constitution to allow that law to be created. You just don't create laws, because that's how they pretend government. Now, anyway, so we're going to go through the Utah, but remember, learn, pray, act in your appeal. We're going to the last section of the Utah Enabling Act is what we're going to go through. Remember, the key, as I said, and I say it all the time, it's about full compliance to the Constitution. And this is why I believe we've just been given this huge opportunity, this huge gift in these days, because the federal government, the state government, everybody's been running around under the pretense that they have these powers when they don't. Therefore, we have all the opportunity availed to us to actually start correcting all of this. And once the people start realizing that the lack of a county constitution is so imperative, it is the paramount center of our governing lives, everybody will start understanding the necessity of a county constitutional convention. The apparent movement of a state constitutional convention, or a convention of counties, I'll just say, is imbecilic. You're putting the cart in front of the horse, and it is where you will make your biggest mistakes. And as a matter of fact, there's a good chance that there may be compromises done that people won't even understand what the heck they're doing. Don't let this lure of, oh, we're going to fix one little thing. Don't buy into the myopic argument. This is Satan trying to be divisive and trying to basically divide and conquer us. Oh, well, it's this issue is the more important. The compliance, the full compliance to the Constitution is paramount. Not cherry-picking compliance, full compliance to the Constitution is paramount. Don't let anybody tell you, oh, well, this will bring you your full compliance. There's no single myopic act out there that will actually solve the problems. And every single problem is insurmountable when we actually create the amalgamation of all of them, which is why we have to demand full compliance, not partial. So with that, if you're looking to actually secure the United States government moving forward, I would say it would be in everybody's interest to make sure that the next president of the United States is grounded on the Constitution. What does that mean? Grounded on the Constitution. What that means is that the President of the United States actually demands and fully executes the laws of the Union and starts getting rid of all of these insurrections that are committed against the Constitution, the courts, and everything else, and allows and actually calls upon the states to fix the federal government as well as themselves. And actually point to the counties to say, you need to fix yourselves, you need to fix the federal government, you need to start with the counties first. because you need to figure out what powers you want your county to possess. And when you create your state, you want to make sure they have less powers. And when we go to the federal government, the Constitution is does not need change. As a matter of fact, there are certain things that can actually be taken away from the Constitution to help empower the states and counties, to help empower the distribution of sovereignty and power in the union back to where it really belongs. And these are some of the things of the shortcomings, not necessarily they were shortcomings. I'll just say this, that at the time in 1787, when the Constitution was being drafted, the men in that room didn't understand the complexities, or I should say the simplicity, of this hybrid constitutional republic. That once it actually takes full form, then the concept of a limited and defined government at every level becomes such a beautiful thing. This becomes the true beacon of liberty for all nations to come unto America as and be admitted as a state in the Union. And folks, I hate to sound like the kumbaya guy, but that's how world wars never start ever again. When everybody is arguing and basically demanding full liberty, full sovereignty, individual sovereignty and individual liberty being the foundation of a good government. Now, let me get into the Enabling Act, the final Enabling Act, or I should say Section 19, because they're 20, of the Utah Enabling Act, that the Constitutional Convention, by ordinance, provide for the election of officers for a full state government, including the members of the legislature and representatives. We kind of covered this before, didn't finish it. In the 54th Congress, at the time for the election of the ratification or rejection of the Constitution, but the said government shall remain in abeyance, basically impotent, shall remain impotent until the state shall be admitted into the Union as provided by this act. In other words, you got to comply with all these things we've set upon you. In case the Constitution of said state shall be ratified by the people, but not otherwise, the legislature thereof may assemble, organize, and elect two senators of the United States in the manner now prescribed by the laws of the senators or by the laws of the United States, and the governor and secretary of the state of the proposed state shall certify the election of the senators and representatives in the manner required by law. And when such state is admitted into the Union, as provided in this act, the senators and representatives shall be entitled to be admitted to seats in Congress and to all rights and privileges of senators and representatives of other states in the Congress. Now, they're not giving the state equal footing at all, right? In the Congress of the United States and the state government formed in pursuance of said Constitution, as provided by the Constitutional Convention, shall proceed to exercise all the functions of state officers, and all laws in force may be made at the time of its admission shall be in force in said state, except as modified or changed by this act or by the Constitution of the state, and the laws of the United States shall have the same force and effect within the state as elsewhere within the United States. Section 20, that all acts or parts of this act in conflict with provisions of this act, whether passed by the legislature of the said state or by Congress, are hereby repealed. So in other words, they're repealing most of their control, but they're not repealing these specific controls that they've unconstitutionally placed into this. Now, by chance, they basically lay out I'm looking for apportionments, because you notice they only said representatives. There's nowhere in here where I have found apportionment of how many representatives the state was going to be given. And as a matter of fact, they only mentioned a single representative. They don't talk anywhere here about the apportionment and how many states or how many representatives will represent the state. Not at all. They say they can have two senators, and they say that they can elect a representative. But they actually say in this act, the senators and representatives shall be entitled to. But they don't mention, based on the last census, how many that would be. So did Utah come into the union with two representatives? And actually, when you look at all of the states having a requirement for 60,000 people, that means that they should have had at least two representatives by that point in time. Because the Constitution, today even, says that every 30,000 people shall be represented by one representative in the House of Representatives. The representatives cannot exceed 30,000 people to represent. So however you want to slice it, based on population and the population of the state of Utah, which I don't have at the availing of this. And you know what? I did talk about, I think, population when I was looking at the original states. So I could tell you exactly how many representatives each state got out of the original 13, but I can't tell you the representation of Utah in the 1890 census, or what it should have been based on. And by this point in time, by the way, folks, the Congress was already starting to play shenanigans regarding that apportionment. Now, going into the next Enabling Act, the final Enabling Act that I want to go through, because we've already covered Vermont, which was the first Enabling Act. It was one paragraph that this state was to be admitted as a full sovereign state as all states in the Union. That's all they needed to do. And I can understand the perfunctory adding of the boundaries, you know, by placing either the coordinates or these specific landmarks that they were using for this intersection of these rivers or what have you. I understand that. But to place anything else in there that isn't just basic administrative stuff. In other words, they do not have the ability to create any restrictions upon a state joining the Union. As a matter of fact, all forts, magazines, arsenals, and needful buildings that were created prior to that state being admitted into the Union, properties that I just mentioned, the aforementioned properties, you know, magazines, forts, arsenals, dockyards, if it's a seagoing, or if there's a large enough lake that would demand a port between two states or what have you, if that be the case, then they would have the ability to create those things as the state became a member of the Union. But it would first have to be by the approval of the state legislature, as the Constitution dictates. And it must be purchased by the federal government. The federal government was to always basically be in a negative, never to have a surplus, never to have a surplus of wealth. The fact that they're running around with debt, holding debt, and, well, of course, we don't have a surplus, supposedly, but they're not even supposed to have that kind of debt. They're not to have, because they're only capable of spending the money of what they have the power to spend the money on. This is why that debt is fraud. So, as we dive into the Indiana Enabling Act, I want to basically lay this out, that they lay this out in the very title of this. This is the title: An Act to Enable the People of the Indiana Territory to Form a Constitution and State Government, and for the Admission of such State into the Union on an Equal Footing with the Original States, 1816. Now, it's the very end of 1816, but Statute 1, Chapter whatever, Roman numerals, I'm not going to even try to guess. I know that's, 47, 57? L is a 50, I think. L, so 57. An act to enable the people of Indiana Territory to form a constitution and state government and for the admission of such state into the Union on an equal footing with the original state. So they're just repeating the title of the act. Being enacted by the House, by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the inhabitants of the territory of Indiana be, and they are hereby authorized to form themselves a constitution and state government, and to assume such name as they deem proper. And the said state, when formed, shall be admitted into the Union upon the same footing with the original states in all respects whatsoever. So right there, they're done. That's basically all they needed to do. And everything else could have been, you know, perfunctory, what have you, or administrative references like here's your boundaries. But bottom line, the state has full control over its destiny to determine what its name's going to be, what its constitution will be, where that state capital will be, where they choose to do anything with their land and what to do therefore, you know, on and on and on. Now, like I said, they actually have the ability to identify the, let's just call them the boundaries of the state. Where is the outside borders of this state? And it be further enacted that the said state shall consist of the territory included in the following boundaries. So what they do is that then the section 2 goes through the boundaries, and they talk about the common, at the very end, that the said state shall have a concurrent jurisdiction on the River Wabash, with the state to be formed west thereof, so far as the said river shall form a common boundary to both. So, in other words, that's how they ended the boundary part. So, boom, now they're really done. What else do they need to tell them to go do what they want to do? And it be further enacted that all male citizens, so, okay, now they're going to determine how to vote and who to, and how to select their delegates. In other words, they're basically going to get into their knickers and identify the county representatives who are going to go to actually form that state constitution. Now, what I just said, the county representatives, that means that the counties are the parties, not the people. Why aren't the people the parties to the compact? Because people die. And then that would require a transfer of that ownership, that party state of the compact, to somebody else. But see, counties are perpetual. States are perpetual, which is why the counties are the parties to the compact, to the state compact, and the states are the, and as every new state joins the union, it becomes an equal party to that compact. So as counties form in the state, it becomes equal parties to that state compact, the constitutions. And so Section 3, it'd be further enacted that all male citizens of the United States and who shall have arrived at the age of 21 years and reside within the said state at least 1 year previous to the day of election and shall have paid a county or territorial tax. In other words, this is how they got their property tax paid. You want to vote? You want to participate in government? You pay the property tax on the property you own. You have to own property. And all persons having in all other respects the legal qualifications to vote for representatives in the General Assembly of the said territory be, and they are hereby authorized to choose representatives to form to form a convention who shall be apportioned amongst the several counties within the territory. So they're just laying it out that they're going to be apportioned by the population of each county, which county sends the most delegates. Now, keep in mind, in a convention, there is no advantage other than the fact that you can participate in more of the subcommittees if you only have one person that's representing your county. And a few other counties have seven people. And then, you know, between seven and one, it kind of dispersed among the rest of them. But nevertheless, those counties that have seven people will be able to be, it's, you know, distributed across multiple, because you may have one subcommittee that is dealing with education, another subcommittee dealing with, you know, commerce or what have you. And so if you can only be in one committee, you'll only be able to affect the design of such. So the advantage is just not by voting. The advantage is influencing what is to be written. But bottom line, they have the ability to reject or accept everything together as delegations. I'll explain the delegations when we come back from this break. Stand by. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, just as we see with the 12th Amendment, just as we see within the House, the concept was these governing bodies were sovereign, and each sovereign was equal to each other regardless of the amount of people that were in there due to the fact that the areas, the vicinages, these communities, the what we call counties, have their own interests. And one interest of another county, just because they're more populated, cannot overpower or outweigh the interest of the other. This is how the equality and the understanding of equality was to be done in governing, because it wasn't about a democracy. Now, this is why you need to understand these little nuances. Why? Folks, because as we dive into these conventions, these state conventions, first the county conventions, you're going to start realizing that the larger populations are going to try to invoke democracy or a democratic process. Oh, well, we have more people, we deserve to have more say. And then this is where it can actually play right out to allow these population centers. I'll give you a good example, because the state of Washington, same thing with the state of Oregon. If you look at the population center that actually extends from Portland down past Salem, where these two cities are very close to each other, that literally becomes almost the majority of that state. It's the same thing when you look at Seattle that goes to the far north reaches of like Everett or maybe beyond, and all the way down to Olympia. That right there becomes practically the majority in population of the entire state. Therefore, the counties need to say, if you want to have control over the, you know, your own convention, then you will allow us to basically sever our relationship. Because what this would do is this would allow the little land going north of the Puget Sound to like Everett or so forth down to Olympia, and basically carve around all of those counties to allow that to become one state, and the rest of Washington going all the way out to the Pacific Ocean, to the top of the Olympic Peninsula, kind of wrapping into the Puget Sound down to Tacoma. Therefore, I mean, we're talking about a lot of coastal land and coastal area that would be available for the Eastern Washington, and that Seattle, that basic small area, would be left as its own state. What they'll find is they'll find that they can't grow their own food. They'll become dependent. They'll be more dependent than the rest of the state. But who cares? As long as they have control of their own destiny and they can invoke their democracy. But oh, wait, the Constitution does not allow democracies to prevail. It requires a republican form of government. Therefore, if they use a democracy in trying to establish their government, then somebody easily at the federal level should be crying foul, saying, nope, you can't do that. You actually have to allow this concept of delegation, where each of the counties having their own interest should have equal say between them, period. And they're not going to even like that. Kane County will not like that going up to Snohomish County and down to Pierce and beyond. I think Tumwater, whatever, down to Olympia. But nevertheless, the point is this, folks, that that's how the Constitution was formed, and that's how every state constitution was formed, by delegation. And you will respect the sovereignty of the land and the government that the people have established. Now, there's a good chance in the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, and many of these really, blue states, because the when you look at a blue state, the majority of the counties are what? Red. And those red counties will have their constitutions. And those constitutions will demand that this new constitution not allow the delegation of power, because it's already been delegated to the county, will not allow the delegation of the power to the state. There you go, right there. That's one of the key reasons why creating a state constitution before you have your county constitutions formed would be fatal. Because now you've actually allowed the delegation of powers to be maintained if you're only fixing one problem. And it makes it harder to form the second convention, because everybody all of a sudden will be licking their wounds to go, well, that hurt. We don't want that to happen. And who knows, they may invoke a 20, 40, 30-year moratorium on the next convention as a compromise. Yeah, that's right, because political compromises is what screwed up this country. You want this? You want to be able to do that? We're not going to vote. We're not going to form this. Folks, we cannot allow ourselves to be compromised when it comes to demanding full compliance. And this concept of single myopic ideas and compromises, so that we can at least get the one little thing that, this one little feather in our, in our cap, it's reprehensible. These are self-serving agendas, period. Now, as we go back through this, he's talking about the amongst the several counties within the said territory, according to the apportionment made by the legislature thereof at the last session, to wit, from the county Wayne, 4 representatives. From the county Franklin, 5 representatives. From the county of Dearborn, 3. From the county of Switzerland, 1. I got to tell you, folks, when it came to naming counties, towns, and everything else in the United States, we really lacked imagination. I tip my hat to the Western states that actually adapted to the Indian names. Walla Walla, Tacoma, Seattle, so forth. Anyway, so they're going through the different representatives. One representative from Perry, one representative, and the election for the representatives aforesaid shall be held on the second Monday of May, 1816, Holden, throughout the several counties in the said territory, and shall be conducted for the manner and under the same penalties as prescribed by the laws of the said territory regulating elections therein, members of the House of Representatives. Now, keep in mind, I read to you the Ohio Enabling Act that did not include the Northwest Territory, right? And so as we go through, and Section 4, and be further enacted, that the members of the convention thus duly elected are thereby authorized to meet at the seat of government of the said state. So they've already determined what the seat of government is. Remember, under Article 4, Section 3, Congress has the power to make needful rules and regulations. So they established what they wanted as their seat. And here Congress is saying you will use that as your seat of government. Well, hold on here. The state has every right to determine where it wants its capital to be. And maybe they don't want it there. Maybe the smart money is allowing that because of the commerce lanes and everything else. Whatever that Indianapolis, I think, is the state. Maybe, I don't know, Gary? I'd have to look it up what the capital of the state is. Because right now I forgot. Nevertheless, if you look at where the area is, it might be smarter to put the seat of government somewhere in a less developed area. When we look at many of the states, the fact that Pierre is the state capital, because I don't know if it was the biggest, but today it makes reason because it's less affected by the major cities. The federal government was placed into the District of Columbia as an unpopulated area, and therefore that district was autonomous from the states. In trying to maintain that spirit of autonomy, you want your state capital to not be within a very particular city that may have already a corner on the population. The majority of the counties who, remember, by delegation should say, no, we don't want it there. That's already the hub or the center of the state. There's too many you have the greatest population. We do not want you influencing our state government. Therefore, they move it out into a very remote area to basically serve the entire state or its counties. Anyway, so and are hereby authorized to form a constitution and state government, or it be deemed more expedient, the said constitution shall provide by ordinance for selecting representatives to form a constitution. So in other words, they could do it that way, or they could actually, as this body, delegate representation. Now, nobody's ever done this. Every time they have established a convention, they move forward in creating, because they don't want to abdicate the responsibility. They want to actually, because, you know, my name goes down as a framer. Why would I give that, that privilege to somebody else, right? It's most people are self-serving. Which said representative shall be chosen in such a manner and in such proportion and shall meet at such time and place as prescribed by that ordinance, provided that the same, whenever formed, shall be Republican and not repugnant to the articles of the ordinance of the 13th of July, 1787. Now, what the heck is that? What the heck is this ordinance of the 13th of July, 1787? That's an ordinance, and that date is the date while the Constitutional Convention was convening. Hold on here. They're pointing to some ordinance that has actually been superseded by the Constitution in forming this state, which declared to be irrevocable between the original states and the people of the state of the territory northwest of the River Ohio, accepting so much of said articles as relate to the boundaries of the states therein to be formed. Now, hold on here, folks. They're basically pointing to the Northwest Ordinance. And as we already looked at Indiana coming into the state, Ohio already came into the state. So how is it that Indiana was basically cherry-picked as a state being invoking some arbitrary rule that was actually superseded by the Constitution? I'll tell you why. Because by superseding it, by playing this game, oh, well, we're going to go ahead and allow something that was superseded by the Constitution, because the Constitution was ratified, Continental Congress, and that treaty was abrogated because Continental Congress didn't have the method of adjoining states into the Union. The Constitution did. And they created, it was very clear that they would come in on their own accord, under their own terms, and have their own self-determination with equal footing as all the other states. The Northwest Territory didn't do that. So, and to be clear, the Northwest Territory basically ensured that the state had to be brought in without slavery. It dictated the specific Bible that they would use, or actually, I think it at least dictated that they would use the Bible, making a law thereof respecting religion, regarding the schooling and education and so forth. Anyway, Section 5, and it be further enacted that until the general census shall be taken, the said state shall be entitled to one representative in the House of Representatives. And it be further enacted, Section 6, that the following propositions be and the same are hereby offered to the convention of the said territory when formed for their free application or rejection, which, if accepted by the convention, shall be obligatory upon the United States. And they go into the numbered 16 in township, because they say that the section numbered 16 in every township, and when such section be sold, granted, or disposed of, other lands equivalent thereto and most contiguous to the same shall be granted to the inhabitants of such township for the use of schools. So they're already dictating that, you know, that we've broken your land into these sections, and that on 16, in the cell of 16, that the adjacent lands will be for a school. That all, right here, that all salt springs, that Northwest Ordinance didn't even include salt springs. Didn't include anything like that. It basically talked about slavery. It talked about education. It didn't have national interest. That all salt springs within the territory and the land reserved for the use of the same, together with such other lands as may, by the President of the United States, be deemed necessary and proper for working the said salt springs, not exceeding the whole, the quantity contained in 36 entire sections shall be granted to the sets. In other words, they're basically saying that these things will be held in this specific way, you know, be granted to the said state for the use of the people of the said state, the same to be used under such terms, conditions, and regulations as the legislature of the same state shall direct, provided the state legislature shall never sell or lease the same for a longer period than 10 years at one time. In other words, you can't sell them outright. You can only lease them for 10 years at a time. In other words, because they look at these things as national resources. So already, when we compare Louisiana not even being a part of the United States territory until the Treaty of 1803 and the Louisiana Purchase, now it comes into the Union with complete and equal footing, with no reservations by the federal government. You have to be slave, you have to do this, you have to do that, nothing. Ohio, prior to Louisiana, came into the Union without any reservations as well, and no strings, no ties to the Northwest Ordinance. Well, so why all of a sudden are they doing this? Well, down the road, and what we exposed in the Utah Enabling Act were these ordinances, these acts that Congress had passed in, I think, either the 1830s and or the 1840s, long before they created the Department of the Interior. And it also points to how the Secretary of the Interior now controls all these unconstitutional federal lands that the federal government is making claim to. Remember Article 4, Section 3. Remember that it talks about such claims that cannot prejudice the claims of another state or the state itself, nor can it prejudice the claims of the federal government. Only those claims that are within the Constitution can the federal government make. So again, when we look at Article 4, Section 3, the Congress, this is what it says, the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property belonging to the United States. So in other words, folks, as long as the federal government is controlling and regulating that as a territory, they can make all the needful rules and regulations necessary. When it becomes a state, they cannot. When it becomes a state, all that land is transferred to the state as they're being admitted, because they're a full sovereign state. Therefore, we have to go to Article 1, Section 8, at the very end of Section 8, because this is where it says this concept, right, of, you know, possessing land. And I'm going to bypass, because it starts off with the exercise of exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, as may by secession, we're talking about the District of Columbia, as may by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States, and to exercise exclusive like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the state legislatures of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of. So here's the list. Here's the list of what the federal government can possess if the state legislature allows it. They have to purchase it for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. You see me anything forest, mountainous, rivers, lakes? How about people? You know, they're going to possess, you know, they're going to take control of this land. They're going to buy this land and they're going to put a bunch of people on it, like indigenous people, and control them there in your state. No, the only reason that these were allowed to be possessed by the federal government within the state was for defense purposes. This was all either for defense or for the importation of commerce from foreign goods. This is why dockyards for the Navy and dockyards for the importation of commerce coming from foreign land and other needful buildings would be a part of this. So, folks, I am literally laying it out to you how the federal government has literally perverted the Constitution through these enabling acts to basically make the assertion that we can claim any land we want. We don't even have to amend the Constitution. Folks, don't let that lie or deception fool you. They must amend the Constitution. So the next, the very next, I'll just say content I'm going to cover after these enabling acts. We're wrapping it up today. So in my next content, who knows, it might be tomorrow, but I don't think so. By Friday, at least, I will probably do my next content. And this is where I am going to dive into Madison's veto of the bonus bill and Monroe's veto of the bonus bill and Jackson's veto of a bonus bill. These three bills that were designed to establish the footings for the Department of Transportation. And clearly, Madison pointed out in his veto statement, his admonishment back to Congress, that that power doesn't exist. For you to exercise that power, you must amend the Constitution. So the power to possess land other than these pieces of land would require an amendment to the Constitution, as a matter of fact. You know what? Before I dive into the amendments, or I should say the Department of Transportation and the clear requirement for an amendment, we're going to give you the Thomas Jefferson Amendment of 1803. Thomas Jefferson recognized that the federal government could not transfer land to the federal government, or not to the federal government. The federal government could not transfer lands to Indian tribes. Their job was to serve the states and to do all the bidding for the states. And they said, hey, states, why don't you let us transfer some of this newfound land that we got out of this Louisiana territory and set it aside and create a state for the Indians. Now, do you believe that Thomas Jefferson was, you know, somebody that, you know, white man hating Indians? Do you believe that the framers were really of that paradigm? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. They kind of recognized this necessity. But because Congress refused to do it, the only way past this, the only way to correct this, was done by the divine hand of providence in the 14th Amendment. What that means is the 14th Amendment in Article or Section 1 of the 14th Amendment was the Declaration of Citizenship, that all people born or naturalized in the United States and under the jurisdiction thereof, if they're born in the United States and under the jurisdiction, they become a U.S. citizen. So by 1861, actually this was 1866 when the 14th Amendment passed, by this point in time, the complete contiguous United States from the farthest corner that we know in Washington, that little island right there of British Columbia split between British Columbia and the state of Washington. So that little island down to the tip of the Florida Keys, all the way up to the very corner of those islands of Maine, down to just below the San Diego County line, just to down to that bottom county line of San Diego, Those were the four corners of the United States. Every line and every boundary that we see and recognize today had been formed. That and all land that was either states in the Union, which are under the jurisdiction of the United States, as well as the territories under the jurisdiction. So if an Indian, an indigenous person, was born from the 1840s or whenever, any person born while under the jurisdiction of the United States, and I you'd have to have the ancestry and the documents to prove as an indigenous person that you were not born under the jurisdiction of the United States, so therefore you're not a citizen, but your child afterwards, any child afterwards, after that point in time, does become a citizen because they're born within the United States and under the jurisdiction thereof. Even though the constitutional land, the federal land, is unconstitutional, I should say, the constitutionality of these reservations for the Indians was absolutely unconstitutional. The fact is, every state in the Union is under the jurisdiction of the United States and all people therein. So, we have a quagmire. We have quite a mess. But bottom line, Congress rejected this amendment. And therefore, this is what fixed that. But because there were plenty of evil people that quickly assumed control. Now, remember, these radical Republicans who were trying to heal America were quickly ousted. As a matter of fact, they started taking a beating in the election of 1868. And then in 1870, England successfully pushed enough of the radical Republicans out to where they could seize control, and that is where they basically created the Organic Act, which then allowed this unconstitutional state of the District of Columbia, because they created a governor. We already read this for you this year. That was where, in their own state documents of the District of Columbia, where they started creating these treaties, incorporations, and those types of things that allowed them. It's not in any federal documentation. Why? Because the federal government, Congress, actually unconstitutionally abdicated their responsibilities. What they had to do to allow the District of Columbia to become a state is to amend the Constitution to create that governor so that Congress would no longer. So all of these things that they did, the creation of the District of Columbia and the governor and the government abdicating Congress's responsibility of exclusive legislation, was a violation of the Constitution, because clearly it says right here, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district. That had to be changed, and they didn't do it. So the reality is, what you're looking at within, you know, the operations and what we see in the formation of all these entities, these corporations, and so forth, they're not legitimate. To make them legitimate would have required an amendment and basically the states delegating that power so that they could do those things. And because they never obtained that, bottom line, they violated the Constitution, and it's a mess we have to clean up. And thank God the divine hand of providence blesses the way he did with this Constitution and all of its amendments. I'm J.R. Mobley with Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.